Do you know how many times I've set the intention that on Sunday, I'm going to get up, I'm going to plan my meals out for the week, I'm going to go to the store, I'm going to get everything that I need, I'm going to come home, I'm going to make all my meals for the week. Do you know how many times I've actually been successful in doing that? Not once, folks, okay? Not one single time. But alas, I have found the perfect solution. Meet Sunbasket, a team of dietitians and chefs that design wholesome, nutritious, and delicious meal kits delivered to your damn door. You get to pick and choose what you're in the mood for every week. Maybe one week you're feeling Mediterranean, maybe another week you're feeling a little carb consciousness. I like the sound of that. I most recently made, it was a spinach and strawberry salad with steak. It was damn good. So go to sunbasket.com/adultchild today to save $120 across your first 4 deliveries. That's sunbasket.com/adultchild to save $120 across your first 4 deliveries, plus free shipping on your first order. I want to be in a relationship where you telling me you love me is just a ceremonious validation of what you already show me. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the great debate, is a hot dog a sandwich? I'm just kidding. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Just got to keep you on your toes, folks. Is a hot dog a sandwich? Let's talk about this. It's like, I don't really consider it a sandwich, but it is a sandwich. Do we consider a burger a sandwich? I don't think so. I think that we consider a burger, and I feel like we should have it like in a different category. It's like in the handheld category. I don't know. Let me know what you think. I think a burger and a hot dog are not a sandwich. Okay, you are probably not listening to this podcast anymore. So for any new listeners, my name is Andrea, and I am obviously a complete and total shit show with the sense of humor of a 6-year-old man. I am Larry David in the flesh and proud of it. I am also a recovering alcoholic. I am an adult child of an alcoholic. And I realized that my childhood screwed me up a whole lot more than I initially thought after dating 2 alcoholics named Brian back to back. And if you have not heard that story, you need to go back to my very first episode and listen to that shit. It is required listening. And go take a listen to the first, 10 or so episodes, which is where I really go into my story. You're going to feel a lot more connected to the show if you hear my story. And also that is where I lay a lot of the foundation as far as what this term adult child means. So when I started this podcast in my closet on the floor next to my cat's litter box, I was intending to maybe do 8 to 10 episodes, and folks, I never stopped. Here we are, and we are at episode 177. Holy cow. So yeah, we curse here. You've been warned. I'm an acquired taste. You've been warned. And if I'm your kind of taste, you're really going to love this shit. So today we are diving deep with widowed retired therapist turned narcissistic abuse survivor turned YouTube sensation turned author of Love You More, the harrowing tale of lies, sex addiction, and double cross, and GCOA, grandchild of an alcoholic, Carrie McAvoy. So I was looking one day for videos on female friendships with covert narcissists and found one of Carrie's videos and was like, gotta get her on the damn pod. So you're getting a two-parter, folks. So as you know, if you're a returning listener, the very first question that I always ask is, tell me how you realized that your childhood screwed you up a lot more than you initially thought that it did. Well, it took her an hour to answer that question. It took her a whole hour. So today, you're going to get to hear all about the narcissistic relationship that she found herself in after losing her husband of decades suddenly to cancer, which was the aha moment for her that her childhood screwed her up a whole lot more than she initially thought that it did. And then next week, we're diving into more topics like narcissistic friendships and autism and all the things. So let's get the damn show on the road. You're going to love this. But first, let's talk about why you, yes, you, need to damn the Join Shit Show. This is my online support community where I host 4 weekly Zoom support groups. This is not affiliated with the 12-step program ACA in any way. This is not a substitute for ACA in any way. Our groups are similar, but a little bit looser. We do allow crosstalk from the perspective of it's totally cool to comment on how you might relate to somebody else's share. We do avoid offering unsolicited advice, but I think crosstalk can be powerful and useful when it's from the perspective of being able to relate your experience directly to the experience that somebody else has shared. We have an app. This is a support community at your fingertips. If you're looking for a group of people to see you, get you, understand you, support you, accept you, love you, and also want to have a little fun and laugh while we do this incredibly difficult work of breaking the cycle, then this is the community for you. I just wanted to let you know. So our Monday night group, we'd been going through the Loving Parent Guidebook. We just finished going through that. I'd like to go through the book again, but I do want a little bit of a break before we go through it again. So I've made the decision that for our Monday night group, it's at 8:30 p.m. Eastern, 5:30 p.m. Pacific, that we're going to be reading Pia Melody's book, Facing Codependence. So we'll read for like 15 or 20 minutes and then share. So if you're interested in participating in that group, I'm planning on starting it this upcoming Monday. So September 9th at 8:30 p.m. Eastern. So see the link in the show notes. It's less than $1 a day. Is your recovery worth less than $1 a day to you? I think that it is. Okay, so let's damn the Join Shit Show. See the link in the show notes. Next, give me a little follow on the Insta, on the TikTok, at Adult Child Pod. And last but not least, whatever the hell you do, please give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple, on Spotify. Thank you. Love you all. All right, we're in for a damn treat. We have Dr. Carrie McAvoy, retired psychologist, YouTube sensation, host of Breaking Free from Narcissistic Abuse.
You got it.
Okay, cool. And a fellow, I'm going to call you a recovering shit show. So you can take it. Are you okay with that?
I am. Yeah, I think people would agree with you.
So you're an adult child.
Right. Yeah, I'm an adult grandchild.
Oh, a GCOA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you see? So that was my first TikTok video that ever went viral was about GCOAs. Who knew?
Yeah, no, when I heard that, I actually heard you talk about that. I was really blown away. It's, oh my goodness. My father was like in such a reactive mode from growing up with all that alcoholism that he was like a teetotaler. On the other hand, I think there was a lot of addictive behavior to his, or at least sober kind of addictive behavior, because he didn't deal with his feelings. He would shut down. He had a volatile mood. We definitely tiptoed around him a lot. You could tell how broken he was and unhealed he was from his experience. I mean, I'm going to sound like I come out of the off some hill somewhere, but my mom and dad are step cousins. And my mom and dad are step cousins.
Mm-hmm,
yeah, I know. So my dad's stepdad, who is the alcoholic, was so severe, is my mom's uncle. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's the connection. So it was my mom's uncle and my dad's stepdad. And he was so severe that he had my dad driving him home from the bar at 12, you know, with a board on the foot, trying to get him home safely, drink the family's paycheck before they could even spend it on anything. And at one point they burned, their house burned, and they lived in a tent for a while. Oh, it was ultimate shit show. My dad survived. Absolutely. Absolutely.
When did you learn all of that stuff, and from whom?
They just kind of would share it incidentally.
Like as when you were a kid?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd hear about the stories, and maybe not. My dad would get real quiet. He would sort of shut down. The worst stuff, he would get very anxious and overwhelmed and emotionally just shut down and stop talking about. So we knew that there was topics not to get into.
Do you remember what?
What was not allowed? Probably, well, there was also pretty severe abuse going on in that house. So if we brought that up, that just was a kind of an off topic. We really didn't talk about extreme forms of like sexual abuse, physical abuse, those types of things. Yeah, it was, and he was an interesting guy. I think as a psychologist, I think he had a mixed personality disorder. You know, I think he had borderline personality traits with a few antisocial personality traits thrown in there for just good measure. And I'm realizing now that my mom has got some narcissistic traits. So it was a rough home to grow up in. It was interesting because we are Christian. So we had all the trappings of looking fantastic, dressed nice, and role models. We were often the role models in whatever community we were in, whether it was a school or church or whatever. But behind closed doors, the degree of the emotional dysregulation was through the roof. It was just, you know, so no name calling, no like extreme physical abuse, but the degree of gaslighting and dishonesty and emotional numbness was horrific. It led to a lot of neglect, me raising myself, my sisters and I is raising ourselves a lot.
How many siblings do you have?
I have, there's two others. I'm the oldest of three sisters.
Okay.
Then this is the other kind of sad story. I guess I'll go ahead and say this. I usually don't share all of this, but my sister passed away 2 years ago. And she essentially drank herself to death. Mm. She was actively drinking heavily and she was suicidal. She had been from one narcissistic relationship to another, had no hope, right? And she had severe MS. So she was losing her mobility, was not far off from having to use a cane. She had another kind of symptom that caused tremors in her hands. And the tremors in her hands were so severe, she couldn't even put makeup on or write legibly anymore. So she just felt like she was in a physical prison. And I think alcohol just really offered incredible way out
escape,
of life.
Of course.
Oh, absolutely. So she died of a rapid onset of pneumonia, but had complete full liver failure. And they kept asking us at the hospital, does she drink? Is she drinking a lot? And no, we're like, yeah, she does a lot. You know, she can go through a lot. But I didn't want her labeled that way. I just didn't want that, you know, going down on a record that this was due to alcoholism, because it was really because of the pneumonia that brought it on, actually. But she had the kind of pneumonia that you have with an immune compromised system, but she was on a certain kind of MS medication that lowered her immunity. We didn't know that. So she ended up with the type that if you're very immunocompromised, and so it was really rapid and very aggressive.
Well, it's kind of interesting that you say that there, because is that kind of bringing forth like a level of shame, like about alcoholism?
Oh, I mean, absolutely.
You know, is that kind of like enabling in a way?
Yeah. A lot of shame in my family was like, we're hiding stuff. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Hiding stuff. Looking great on the outside, but we're hiding how really, really horrifically awful things are in the inside. How scary, how out of control things feel.
It's so interesting for me because I don't have any shame in the word. You know, I've been sober for, I'll have 16 years next month. Oh, it's coming up. I don't have any shame like with the label alcoholic. I know that a lot of people do. I feel like for me, since I've been like saying, hi, I'm Andrea, I'm an alcoholic since I've been like 13. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm, but it's really interesting to me how people, they don't like that label. They feel like there's a stigma with it, but is there really, or is having that perspective causing the stigma to be with it? You know what I mean?
I do know what you're asking. And I think this is why I use the word victim. I allow myself to be called, I've been a victim. Not that I say I'm a victim today. I'm not being victimized today. I'm definitely am surviving and thriving, but I'm not ashamed of the word that I've been victimized, and I have been a victim for periods of time in my life. And I know that there's tremendous shame in that as well. So here's what I see that for me causes me problems. Am I ashamed that my sister's felt that hopeless and felt that she had no out and that we have a genetic predisposition to alcoholism? No, to me, it's a fact. What I'm uncomfortable with and that I see happen way too often is that society places a lot of stigma on it and then ends up, it affects the kind of quality of care someone might get. And I didn't know if I felt safe enough in that setting. Here she's unconscious, essentially maybe brain dead. That's what we did. We had to remove her from life support. And I didn't want her care to diminish because of them thinking this is related to abuse of alcohol, not related to maybe, and we really never will know, because they also were trying to rule out liver cancer. That was the other thing. It was on one of the big diseases they had concerns about, but we'll never fully know because there was no autopsy.
Yeah,
but I didn't want her care to change. And so I can't always feel like I can't trust the society. I did a 29-part series on TikTok called How I Met, Married, and Got Scammed by a Gold Digger. And the amount, I would some days log in and see hundreds of comments, hundreds. And a lot of them were attacking, shaming, blaming. You know, I had to take it on a chin for weeks that I was pathetic, that I should have known better, that what business did I ever have to be a psychologist, that I should have had my degree removed. I mean, I heard all sorts of nasty stuff from, and you know who the worst were? It was women, other
women. Of course.
So I thought it would be the men coming out. No, you know what's happening is the men, especially a certain group of men, of like thinking that I'm going to be the next date for them. Dude, go away. I've got hundreds of offers. Like, hundreds of offers.
I see what her type is. No, I just want to circle back. I wasn't really, when I was bringing up that point with alcoholism, it wasn't necessarily directed to you and your story. It's just the question of like, by people feeling not wanting to use that label, it's just the question of like, is that perpetuating that we feel like this is something shameful? You know what I mean? It's just like something to think about. I mean, I don't know one way or the other, but yeah. It's just a thing.
Yeah, and that's why I use the word victim is because I don't want to perpetuate that. I think there's nothing shameful in that. I did not victimize myself. Somebody came into my life and lied to me and then took advantage of me. That happened to me. I didn't. But yeah, I do. I think whenever we see behavior that we think should be able to be controlled, and that's the other illusion, is alcoholism really, how controllable is it when you're in the throes of the disease?
It's not.
Yeah. We say it's the victim. It's the person with the disease's problem. It's their failure. I mean, look what we do with weight. Mm-hmm. In fact, I just heard a big, on the Diary of CEO, one of the top doctors in the whole world came on and they interviewed him about weight and overweight. And he said two things. He said, obesity is a disease. And he said, the second thing is it is curable. We just haven't been able to cure it in humans. We've cured it in animals. But he said, for us to walk around and say that people being overweight is their fault, he said, is wrong. And we've known that for years, for decades. It is a myth. It is a disease. So I think when we see things like that, we just love to say, oh, if you just stop eating, things would get better. If you just stop drinking, that problem would go away. But it's way more complicated than that.
I know. And this is for anybody who needs to share this part right here with any of their family members or friends. Acknowledging why you are the way that you are, acknowledging like, oh, the reason I have this sense of impending doom is because I grew up in a dysfunctional family. That's not being a fucking victim. That's just understanding the causes and conditions that made you the way you are. That's what I get just all the time. Like, oh, stop blaming. I'm like, I'm not blaming anyone. I'm just explaining something, you dipshit. Yeah.
Exactly. I agree with you. Yeah.
That's the best, is you can always tell who the toxic family members are by the comments, right?
Yeah, I know. Oh, I know. Yeah. Yesterday. I got slammed. I got slammed for saying that I'm autistic, that I was hurting all the thousands of children who were suffering. And I thought, what an ableist comment. You have no idea of my capabilities or disabilities. Just because I've been able to become a psychologist and get married and raise children does not mean I don't have disabilities.
Mm-hmm. That's like the Instagram I just went viral. It has 11 million views, but it says basically how when my therapist tells me your toxic family members will choose to see you as the version of yourself that they had the most power over you know? Like the people that are like commenting on it. Well, hopefully you found a therapist that lets you know that you're not always the problem. So like you have a family member that a therapist has said this to, right?
Yeah. Wow, that's a powerful statement. I love that. Jeez, yeah. I'm going to have to go find it. That's incredible.
Okay, let's just circle back. I want to know, when did you realize your childhood fucked you up a lot more than you thought it did?
After that last relationship.
Okay.
Yeah, so just recently, the last 5 years, you know, so here I am in my early 60s. And I would say
you've been a therapist for,
20 years. Yeah. Yeah, I know. And even, you know, it wasn't until I heard one of your episodes talking about, how did you say it? Like grandchildren of alcoholics. I'm like, oh shit. That was, oh man. And then I paused and looked at my family like, oh yeah, it's everywhere. And I don't know why I didn't see it. It wasn't, I was starting to say maybe I was in a lot of denial. I don't know. I just didn't label it or see it that way. But I missed it. I missed it until.
But you were the hero child?
Well, I varied. I was the parentified and the scapegoat.
Okay.
Because my autism made me kind of nerdy and weird, a little different. So they didn't always know what to do with that part of me. So they would say, so I scapegoated a lot. But then also because I was so, I showed up and colored within the lines. I'd even ask you, how thick should the lines that I'm coloring be? You know, I'm just so careful.
I definitely want to circle back to the autism thing because it's actually something I haven't talked about on this show. But let's go through this relationship. Give me the highlights, or let's hear it. Give me the juicy deets.
So I was widowed in 2015, and it happened rather suddenly. My late husband and I had been together. I'd known him for 33 years, been together for 31, and he was diagnosed with a terminal cancer that I had never even heard of. It was duodenal cancer, which is small intestinal cancer just below the stomach. It is a really rare, very rare disease. It only strikes 5,000 people in the United States a year. There is no treatment for it. And you find it really late stage, and it's very rarely treatable because it's usually so late stage. And sure enough for him, it was stage 3B when they discovered it. He was dying because it closed off his ability to eat. So he needed immediate surgery so he wouldn't die of starvation. And he recovered enough from the surgery in order for them to do treatment. He had already moved to stage 4. He opted out of treatment, went into hospice care, and then passed away. From diagnosis to death was 5.5 months.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was a rough go.
How old were your kids then?
My kids were 24, 21, and 17. The last was in high school trying to graduate. And he died a day or two after my last one walked the worker's diploma. In fact, I tried to show him the video of it, and he was too far gone to even see it. I kept saying, "See, look, your youngest walked. He graduated from high school today." It was so sad. I mean,
did you just go into like healer mode? Were you just so like focused, or did you have feelings, or were you
I was devastated. We were also building our retirement home. In the midst of it, we were building our retirement home, had to stop that. So I was losing the house we were moving to. We were living in an apartment. So we were mid-transition. My dog had just died the year before. So I had lost my dog. My last child's leaving home, graduating, and going to be an empty nest. And I had to stop working because I believe today, I don't have proof of it, that the cancer traveled to his brain. He had an early onset of dementia brought on by the cancer. So he needed me home full time to take care of him. But honestly, I cried. I sobbed every day. Every day that he was sick, I sobbed. At night, he would go to bed early because he was so tired, not feeling good. And I would sit out in a chair, turn on some very dark music, and just sob until I fell asleep. And then I'd stumble to bed, get up and go to work and go to work taking care of the house and keeping us afloat and running him to his appointments. And then at night, I would do the same thing over again. It's interesting because at the time, my middle son had lost a job and lost his housing and briefly was homeless. And then we discovered it and brought him back and had him living in the basement. We had no even extra bedroom. We had to put him in the basement of this apartment, house that we owned. We happened to own it.
Was he like, had you kind of kicked him out or like, why?
No, we haven't. We hadn't kicked him out. He's very autistic and he just wanted to be independent, and things had kind of fallen apart and he didn't really want to come home and tell us it had fallen apart on him. I don't know why. I mean, I think he was just trying to solve it the only way he knew to solve it. So anyway, we found out, brought him home, and just recently, he and I lived together actually. And just recently he said to me, Mom, I knew we'd be okay. And I looked at him and I said, I was sobbing every day. And he goes, I know, I could hear you, but then you'd be up the next morning and back to work and I knew we'd be okay.
How many kids? You have three, you said?
I have three sons.
How did they each handle it?
Yeah, well, the oldest was away. He was working in North Carolina as a computer programmer. So he wasn't home very often. So he would come home whenever he needed to. And then the middle one was living with us in the basement. And then the youngest was going to school and he was driving to school and trying to just, make it. Although he was having to do all that on his own. I knew I did this. I abandoned him. I checked out and abandoned him. And that caused a lot of problems right after my late husband died. Then that he and I had a rift for a while where he was really angry that kind of went down that way, because here he is going to college with no support. Essentially, I'm a mess. So he you should see the photos of me dropping him off. I mean, we look like a disaster. We look like we had just suffered something horrific, which we had.
Which you did.
Yeah, we had. I mean, we looked dark faces, we were all both overweight. We just looked really sick. Both of us looked really sick. So here I am. All of that's been destroyed. I'm now trying to rebuild life. And I've lost my partner my whole entire adult life. I met him at 19. So I've been with this person my whole adult life. My business has been closed. Now I don't have a new job. I don't know what to do with myself. My last son just left home, and the house I was going to move to is now gone, and the property has been sold, and I'm just left with a shell of a life. I don't know if you've ever been to Mount Lassen in California, which is just Northern California. It's where the last biggest, other than Mount St. Helens, it was one of the last big explosions of a volcano in the continental USA. It has a blast zone that's hundreds of miles. Still today, even if you go, you can tell where it blew off that top of that cone for hundreds of miles is the radius. And it looks still, in a way, dead, like it's been devastated. That's what my life felt like. I kept thinking, this is the blast zone of losing Brad. And it was just utter, I cannot describe how utterly desperate and devastated I was. I felt like I didn't even know if I could survive one more day. That even breathing hurt. My chest hurt, breathing hurt. I was I was spiritually a mess. My faith had been really tattered and shattered by this. It was devastating what happened, what we went through.
How were you getting through the days, and were you self-medicating at all? Were you doing anything?
I'd hang out with a friend most of the day, and then I'd come home and watch TV and go to bed and sob and just try to deal with this pain, this intense, I don't even know how to describe it. It's a horrible pain in your chest where you just feel like you're lost. I felt totally lost, but more alone, more lost than I had ever been in my life. Interestingly enough, no, I didn't. I mean, they put me on medication. They put me on antidepressants. It didn't work. I was on Zoloft for 3 months. I stopped. I've never been a drinker myself, because here's the thing. Me and alcohol don't have a good relationship. It bothers me, makes my heart race, makes my hands and feet swell. So I have a physical reaction to drinking too much alcohol. So it's not something I enjoy or want to do. So
I have an allergy too. I break out in handcuffs.
Do you? So I do actually have a physical, some kind of a physical aversion to alcohol. So yeah, no, I wasn't self-medicating that way. What my therapist, I was seeing a therapist the entire time, and she said, I want you to make a date with pain. Every night, I want you to make a date with pain. I want you to set a timer for 20 minutes, and I want you to use that time to really feel the feelings. And I thought that was the most stupidest idea that I'd ever heard, but I did it. And it helped. It was so helpful. I would sob for a while and then it would go away and I'd start to feel better. And I found every day I would look forward to that time, because I'd think I'd save all the bad feelings up and then I would express it for that 20 minutes. And it really, really helped. Here's the other thing I started doing pretty rapidly. I started writing. I discovered that I love to write. I had already been writing devotionals since 2006, and I'd published a few devotional books and 2010 and 2014, but I decided to write the story of Brad's death. So I started writing a memoir. I'd never tried to do narrative style writing before, so it was a new thing. So that's why I guess what I was throwing myself into was telling the story of his diagnosis and the transition to widowhood, which for me, I've discovered, and in fact, I think this is part of the autism thing, because of how I connect to people and struggle sometimes with social cues, that writing is a really great way for me to process my feelings. And I often don't even know how I feel or think about something until I see it in writing, and I'll read it back. And it's like me talking to myself. It's really, really helpful. And now I know there's all sorts of research supporting that this is a very beneficial thing for everybody to be doing. But I think that's what was really helping me, was that date with pain and writing the story.
The one thing that, I mean, obviously this is one of the, you know, the hardest tragedies that somebody could go through. The other thing that comes up for me, and this isn't to like make light of the situation at all, but I don't know if you know who Susan Anderson is. She's like the abandonment trauma guru, but it's like in those moments, not only are you feeling like that loss, like you're feeling all of the loss that you've experienced throughout your entire life that you've never grieved or dealt with, you know?
Yeah. I didn't realize that, but you're right. That shows up in that next relationship. So yes. And near the end of that relationship, I suddenly had this big aha that I had a mother wound that was massive and that I had been trying to fix it. Because my first husband, when I met him, the night I met him, I fell in love. I felt like I came home. Mm-hmm. He did something that we were at a party. We'd been out most of the night with some friends and I was tired and I laid my head on his knee and we just kind of had met and been talking, and he was so, so sweet and so polite. And he gently put his hand on my arm, upper arm. And I felt like I came home, and he and I became inseparable after that. And 2 years later we married. So when I lost him, I felt affected. Someone gave me a Welsh word. They said to me, it was one of my clients. One of my most scary, worst, difficult clients got a hold of me. She'd been doing great. She had been doing DBT and was really doing well. She circled back and she said, I'm hearing what's happening in your life. I saw this word. I thought of you. It's a Welsh word. It says hirith, and it means a nostalgia or a homesickness for a home that cannot be.
Mm.
And she said, I thought of you when I, and I just wept. It was perfectly, the losing Brad to me was like, Judith, I had lost my home. And so I was homeless, looking for a home. So here I am. So here's where the self-medication came in. I started immediately dating really fast.
How fast?
Oh man, I've never shared this out loud ever.
Let's hear it. No judgment here.
5 weeks.
5 weeks.
Yep. 5 weeks. I was on a dating app. Now, I didn't have my first date until 4 months. Mm-hmm.
There's no judgment from here. On this podcast, we can laugh at this stuff, okay, folks? Right? If we have to be able to find the humor in this shit, okay?
Yeah, yeah. So I was on within 5 weeks, and maybe
were you able to? I'm the type of person that like it takes me forever. I mean, obviously I've never had anybody die, but I mean, I'm just like mourning the fantasy of somebody for like a year, you know? And so the most wonderful person in the world could like come right in front of my face and I wouldn't be into them. But were you able to like,
no, it felt like cheating. Like? Didn't. That's why it took me so many months. So I started, and then of course, they say, how long have you been single? And I think it was like 3 weeks. Maybe it was even five, but a few weeks ago.
You should have just responded. My husband died 3 weeks ago.
Oh, I know. And then they would say, well, I don't think you're ready. I mean, I met some nice guy. I'm like, you're not ready. And like, yeah, well, probably not.
Well, kudos
to you
for actually being honest about it.
The psychologist on the side of me says, no, you're not. But I wanted out of that pain so bad. I wanted the life that I'd lost back. That's what I really, really, really wanted my life that I had lost back. And I felt so angry being at 52. Brad in my best years where we were with kidless, it was 7 years before we had our first child. And we were about to do that again. And I was so excited to have this time alone with him because we were best friends. He was my best friend. And I felt like it was just ripped away. In fact, just yesterday or the day before, I was on Facebook and saw somebody younger than me celebrating their 36th wedding anniversary. I think that's not fair. This year would have been my 40th. I would have celebrated my 40th year. So I was really, really angry. So yeah, I started dating really fast, but I didn't meet my ex until a year later. So I met him, was actually 13 months from when I had lost Brad. And he, you know, I saw him on a dating app and thought he was too handsome. So I skimmed on past. I mean, he looked at my profile because I looked at his, and that's how I made that determination. He looked at mine. And so I decided, hell, you know, why not? I reached out and said, hey, it looks like we have a few things in common. Why not we see if we have more? And he said, sure, why not? So that started, we started texting and chatting. And then
know about him from the profile?
Okay, so what I know now, to me, he would have been a profile I would have swiped left on right away today, the me today. But it was a good profile, very handsome man, very presentable. And he had a bio. It wasn't like, you know how some people throw no bios up at all. He had a bio, but here was the red flag that I didn't pay attention to. He said he had non-negotiables. At the bottom, he goes, I've realized, I think I can only almost quote it. I've realized after meeting some women or some prospects so that I need to be clear on what my criteria is. And here are my non-negotiables. No tattoos, no piercings outside of earrings, no atheists, no pet owners, and no liberals.
No pet owners.
No, he didn't want a pet. He hates pets. So I thought, well, I match all of that. So why not? You know, but today I would have thought, no, I don't want somebody who's already boxing people, putting people in boxes.
Yeah, no, it's kind of interesting to think it's kind of, yeah, maybe you don't throw that out there. I'm trying to think because it's, you know, you can have preferences, but maybe it's.
He said non-negotiable.
Yeah, exactly. You're right. What about age? Were you guys similar in age?
We were. No, people want to. That's the first question they always ask me. Was he a lot younger than me? Are you? I bet he's a lot. No, he was 5 years younger. So he was in his late 40s. He had two kids. They were my kids' ages. He was had a career. He was college educated. There was a lot that we had a lot alike. I mean, we had a similar faith background, similar belief system. The other big difference, he grew up in another country. Okay. So he'd been living in the United States. No, it was Mexico. He was Mexican.
Okay. I was like, those kind of criteria.
It was Mexican, but he was, you know, he was been living in the United States for all of his adult life. He was a permanent resident here. He had a managerial position. So all of that looked good on paper. He looked really good on paper. So we had our first date and, you know, it was nice. It was sweet. There was a couple things that were a little odd, but mostly it felt like he checked all my boxes. I mean, again, I confirmed we're similar age and similar goals, looking for similar things. He did a couple things now that I look back and one was he was way too controlling. Like he wanted to carry all the, we went to Lake Michigan in Michigan. And so we just had a kind of a beach day. But even then we were dressed in shorts. It wasn't like there was nothing, you know, it was appropriate. Mm-hmm. So we had a beach day and we had a lunch, a picnic at the beach. And but he insisted he carry all the stuff and swung it away from me. Wouldn't even let me take any of it and said, no, it's time for someone to take care of you. Now, that sounds really wonderful. But the way he did it was sort of intense, a little intense. And then the other thing was,
you think that was from an image perspective?
Mm-mm. He just really needs to be in control. That's a pervasive thing of this relationship, is control.
That's so interesting. I've never thought about it from that, from carrying things. That's interesting. Okay.
Yeah. But the way it was him swinging away, he literally, here he is burdened down. Like he literally was burdened down. We had so much stuff. So he's like dragging, his shoulders are being dragged down. I said, here, let me take something. My hands are empty. He goes, no. And he swung away. I'm like, this is really weird. So, and the other thing that happened was, he told me a sob story right away. And I thought, well, that's really intimate. He actually shared he'd been sexually abused. Mm. And I'm thinking, whoa, yeah. And with some details, I'm thinking, I've never met a man to admit that out loud, and certainly not on a first date. And then, because I had also survived sexual abuse myself, I'm thinking, okay, so do I share that I have? And how will that be perceived if I don't? I mean, so it put me in this weird position of, I'm not ready. I don't want to talk about that. But I think, all I said, yeah, I understand it's happened to me. And I just kind of like left it at that point. But and then the other thing that he shared, that he'd been married 4 times, there's the biggest one. So I asked, what went wrong? And his reasoning, it wasn't that he attacked the women. It wasn't like he said, oh, she's a bitch, you know, nagged. No, I didn't hear that. That would have been a clear red flag. But his excuses, they felt like one-sided. His reasons were one-sided. He told me what each woman did wrong in a very, well, she was a little too involved with her friends. And the other one was, you know, we just weren't compatible and I wasn't in love with her and I married her really young and I wanted out of the house. Okay, I can see that. And you kind of rushed it. I mean, but every woman, he had reasons that kind of like sat outside of himself. But then he did the thing that kind of convinced me he was better, had done better. He said, but I read this great book, Love and Respect. And I've learned that my mom asked me what was going wrong. And I realized I've never interviewed the women. I just rushed with my feelings. I thought, okay, that's reflective. That's good. You know, that maybe he's learned, maybe he wants something different. But when I got to know him better, that story never changed. It was like he had scripts. I realize now he has scripts. He's a pathological liar. And I think there is some truth to a lot of them, by the way. Yeah. I do think there is some truth to him. But I interviewed the wives after we broke up. So I have their versions now, too, except for one. I didn't interview one of them. But because I wrote a book, Love You More, is this tale of what happened here. Yeah. So but here's the other thing that happened that night. I'm a strong introvert. So he overwhelmed me all day. We were together all day. He's a lot. He's loud and he takes up a lot of space and he's very much an extrovert. So I was very worn out by the end of the day. It made me actually sick. I felt I had kind of an introvert hangover where you just feel awful. So the next day I said, you know what? I'm not in the space to go to church. How about I just drop you off at the airport? But he invited me into his room and they pushed sex really fast, which I didn't want to. And there's my error, is that I was like,
Was this the first date?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And he lived in a different city?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he flew in. He flew in for the overnight, stayed at a hotel, didn't stay with me. Mm-hmm. And the next day he's dressed, packing, and he says, come up and stay, you know, be in the room while I'm packing. And I literally had thought, no, I want to stay in the lobby. I don't want to do this. And I wanted to be nice. And then you know, and I even went, if you looked at us, you'd say, he's over here and she's way over here. You know, it can't be further away from him. I literally was trying to keep space between us. And sure enough, he was kind of like suddenly in my space, pushing himself onto me. And we had that experience. And yeah, I sound like a typical woman. I didn't do enough saying no, even though my behavior says I'm not into this. But I went ahead and I thought, well, hell, why not? And then just went with it. And then he was really weird. He just sort of like, when it was over, he just sort of stood up. Well, should we go to the airport? I'm thinking, well, that's quite a transition. And so we did. But when he got home, he said, hey, I think I pushed you too fast. And see, here's the thing I missed. One of the other things that not good people do is they test and then apologize. That was a test and apologize. So when you see the test and apologize, back way off, because this person's checking to see if they can push boundaries. And they want checking to see what you're going to do when they do push the boundaries.
How conscious is that?
I think with him, very conscious, but I don't think it's conscious with everybody. I think now he's a sociopath. He's a narcissistic sociopath. This was a lot of this is he plans this stuff out. He strategizes. So for me, in this situation, it was intentional, but I'm not saying it's always intentional. I see that pattern a lot. You know, they'll say, hey, baby. And you're like, I don't know you. Oh, I'm sorry about that. I didn't mean anything by that. Mm-hmm. You know, but you still see that test and apologize. It's mm-hmm. a problem. mm-hmm. So the dating period was great, you know, in a lot of ways. There were, you know, again, I could dissect where the problems are, but overall, it felt like a fairy tale. Felt like he was the person I'd been looking for. I felt like I was literally fell madly in love with him really, really fast. And we got married a year later.
How often were you seeing each other?
Probably at least once a month, maybe twice a month, as fast as we could, you know, make it happen.
Communicating constantly?
Yeah, well, he's not a huge he was doing intermittent reinforcement with the communication. So he would like text a flurry of things at night and then disappear and then text a flurry of things. You know, so there was that kind of not consistency, but he was super sweet. He would do things like this that really just blew me away. Like we had a tornado in the area, which is really rare in Michigan. And he heard about it and he called me and all alarmed and said, I'm so worried. I had the impression to want to get in the car and drive to you. But I realized how far away that I can't get there in time. And it was just kind of sweet stuff like that. So it was really like stuff I'd never had in my life that really felt wonderful.
Would you get really anxious when you wouldn't hear from him? Were you
absolutely.
Like that? It was miserable, debilitating?
Yeah, absolutely.
Had you ever experienced that before?
No.
Okay.
Not to that severity. Sucks. No. It was intoxicating. It definitely wasn't. I mean, there's the addiction. It was definitely intoxicating. Felt like I lived to be with him. And then when I wasn't, life turned gray, literally went gray. And then when I was with him, it'd been vibrant again. And then when I wasn't with him, life turned gray. It was awful.
Did anybody know what was going on?
Yeah, but they didn't get to meet him. And I was having a fallout with a big friend at that time because she was afraid I was going to move away. So it wasn't like I had a lot of support. And remember, I'm widowed. So my whole social realm has been devastated. Here's the other weird thing he said on that first date. And I now know it was an admission, but I took it as something sweet. He said he'd been researching, you know, his English is a second language. So I made a lot of accommodations for the way he communicated. He said he'd been researching widows. I assumed he meant he'd been researching information to understand widow issues. No, he meant, I believe he was searching for a widow. And we can all think of why would you be searching for a widow? I missed it. Totally missed it. Here he had signaled what he is up to and I missed it. So there's the scam part.
So you get married after a year. What are your kids? What are your sons thinking?
Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? So Katherine Heigl, you know her from Grey's Anatomy, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says that she's seen more issues with dog joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to improve any dog's health, their food. So what she's discovered is that the way many dog foods are made can actually create toxins that could be wrecking our dog's health. But fortunately, she has found that by just adding a few special superfoods to her dog's food, she saw huge transformation in their health. And she has made a 20-minute video explaining step-by-step how anyone can do this same thing to see incredible changes in their dog's health. Now, y'all know I'm a cat lady. Y'all know that Kiki is the queen of the shit show here. But I watched this video and there's actually some things that I can apply to her health. So hopefully she'll live another 15 years or so. So go to badlandsfood.com/adultchild and watch Catherine's video. Again, that is badlandsfood.com/adultchild. All right, my shit show ladies, let me tell you about how I can make getting dressed so much easier for you. Armoire is a clothing rental membership where you get to build your perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you gotta do is take a 5-minute style quiz and then select from your personalized closet. The styles show up at your door in as little as 2 days. Then when you're ready for new clothes, just swap them out for more new to you styles. So I love this because I'm on video quite often on interviews and social media content. And I don't want people to be like, is that the only shirt that this girl owns? I also would not consider myself in the know of what's hot and what's not. But with Armoire, I get to pretend like I'm a fashionista. So this is perfect for working moms, for stay-at-home moms, for any women who just don't feel like going to the store. Now, right now, you shit show ladies can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% 20% off your first month. So that is up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/adultchild. That is armoire.style, armoire.style/adultchild to get 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear ever again. Okay, shit show dudes, you can tune out. This is for my fellow shit show ladies. Are you going through perimenopause or menopause? I'm not quite there yet, but I know that I have plenty to look forward to. Feeling like a wet sock driving down the highway. Night sweats. Poor sleep. Feeling tired all the time. Bloating. Gas. Man, can't wait for this shit. Now, if that is applicable to you, then you have to try Hormone Harmony. So Hormone Harmony is not just a supplement for women going through perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause. It's become a phenomenon. Women cannot stop talking about it. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 fucking seconds, okay? Now, Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work. Now, for my younger shit show women like myself, if you struggle from that vicious week before your period, you want to crawl out of your skin, experience cravings, want to eat everything in the damn house, you feel a little bit down or off, well, Happy Mammoth also has a product for you to make it easier to manage your PMS with their Estro Control. So for a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code adultchild at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code adultchild for 15% off today.
They love him. Well, the one is living with us and it is love growing and falling and, you know, love for him as much as I did. He's really great to him. Now, if he had lived with us for a long term, would it have stayed that way? I don't know. But see, I think my ex had a motive, and I just told you what the motive was, that he had realized I'd come into life insurance and that he, you know, I no longer had to work. My life clearly looked like something had happened, that I was being able to be independent, didn't need to be working for money. So I think he definitely was keeping himself pulled together to keep it us from, because when I talked to his ex-wives, I heard he was violent and aggressive and abusive. He was not to me. And it was because I think if he showed too much of that side. In fact, I also have proof that that happened because I found out when the relationship was over that the developer, we moved to Mexico. So I didn't tell you that part, but we moved to Mexico. But the developer, and it was my idea. He did not suggest that, but he was, on the other hand, encouraged it, happy about it. But the developer would ask me in the hallway, how are you doing? And I kept thinking, why is this guy being nice to us? Because we're holding him to some penalties that is bad on him and great for us. He should hate me. We're in contention with each other. Why are you being so sweet? Well, I found out that when we would get into a fight, my ex and I, my ex would go to the elevator, tear it apart on the way down as he's stonewalling me. And they assumed that if he's doing that to the elevator, what in the world was he doing to me? And that was the first question. The woman had lived with him for 17 years. She said, did he hit you? Was he abusing you? And I said, no. And she goes, then you're very lucky. So yeah, we get married and we move to Mexico and I open a vacation rental business and I sink all my capital into this company. And then I made a grave error because I didn't understand Mexico. I didn't understand starting a company. I didn't understand powers, administrative and financial powers. And I made him 50% owner of a business he had no capital in.
Was he working at this point?
He lost his job a few weeks before we got married. Which is typical.
The reason?
I saw the severance letter. It just said he was let go. But if you look at his history, he's losing jobs every year and a half. So he wasn't able to maintain a job anywhere. Yep. And I also now know that he was predatory at work and that he was sexually harassing women. He's a sex addict, by the way. I don't know if you picked that up. He was actively, horrifically acting out in the entire time of a relationship. I now know that when we were dating, he was seeing a minimal of 7 women, minimum. And plus it was on dating apps and doing all sorts of stuff. So
yeah, no time to work. I mean, of course he got fired.
No, in fact, he had dark circles under his eyes. And I remember even my son was concerned. We kept saying, this is something, the stress of his life is killing him. He looks awful. Well, when you're trying to maintain that many relationships, that's a lot of work. Mm-hmm. So, and he had a girlfriend. He had a girlfriend throughout the whole relationship. And I now know, I have proof of this, actually, that they met up at every juncture of our change in our relationship. So he asked me to go study. They met up. He asked me to get married. They met up. We get married. They meet up. We break up. They meet up. We then start to divorce. They meet up. And they were kind of like together. And now I don't have proof of this, but I wonder to what degree was their planning and strategy, because his favorite movie was Steve Martin and Michael Caine. And it's that one about them scamming people. I'm trying to think of the name. He would even quote it, you know. So I wonder, okay, was this like a, you know, real life scenario of him and her running this on me? It could have been. I don't know. I don't have any proof of that. But it does look suspicious that, you know, it's interesting. Every big juncture, that it's almost, are you planning? Are you like planning this out? But yeah, so I get into this marriage. And on our honeymoon, we took a delayed honeymoon just before we moved to Mexico. I went to Jamaica. But there's where everybody on TikTok thinks I married a Jamaican. I did not marry a Jamaican. I went to a Jamaica for a honeymoon. I feel bad that Jamaica has come under such scrutiny because of my story. And I'm hearing how terrible Jamaica is. And it's sad. Actually, it's very, very sad. And I have hundreds of Jamaican men who think I'm suddenly interested in dating. And I don't know.
That's
guys,
so
really
good.
Seriously.
I love it.
So, but we went to Jamaica, and on a honeymoon night, he opts out of sex to watch TV. And I fall asleep while he's watching TV, wake up finding him watching pornography, chatting with a woman, confront him about it. That's my first tip off that this guy is not faithful. I didn't know that. I had no clue up to then, absolutely none. So this is 2 months into our marriage. And then on their last night of honeymoon, we work it out. We actually have a little bit of a spat, but we work it out. Things get better. I have a great week. But at the end of the week, I wake up on the last night to a letter from a woman saying, are you married to so-and-so? Well, I've been dating from him for the past 3 months. So I guess
what
the
do you
joke's
mean a
not
letter?
Just... Yeah, it was an email. It
oh,
was
an
email.
Email
letter.
Okay, I was like,
yeah, it was she sent me a, I'm sorry, she Facebook messaged me.
Okay.
She Facebook messaged me and said, are you married to so-and-so? I've been dating the past 3 months. So I guess the joke's not just on me. It's on you too. Mm-hmm. And my world shattered. My world shattered. I suddenly realized I had married a stranger. And here I am. My house has been sold in the United States because I did buy a house and move near him shortly before we got married. It's already sold the car. We had visa in process for me to become a resident of Mexico. We had property that we were closing on. I had to get into Mexico to finish the visa. I don't speak Spanish enough. I have a minor in it, but I'm not. I mean, it had been 30 years since I used it. And I've just discovered I'm married to a stranger. And I don't know what to do. And I don't know how to stop what. And I don't know how to stop this. I don't know where to go, who to talk to, how to stop it. So I do what I know is we get into an intensive program for sex addiction for 3 days, thinking maybe that will start the ball rolling. At least maybe we can identify the problem and get some treatment planning going that we can carry forward into Mexico. That's my solution. And in that process, which was not really helpful, for me, it wasn't. It treated me like what didn't exist, like I hadn't been traumatized when I'd been severely traumatized by this. I was really a mess. But what I did come out of it was they said he had a severe sex addiction and they needed upward to a year of hospitalization. And I'm thinking, what? First of all, this is going to be all out of pocket. So who's going to pay for that? That's hundreds of thousands of dollars. And then how does that work? And
like
I can't
inpatient a year.
Yeah,
inpatient.
They said he needed residential treatment, you know, months and months of residential treatment.
Wow.
I'm thinking this is in. But here's the thing. I didn't know what they were referring to. What does severe sex addiction mean? Yeah. Nobody. I mean, it's not discussed in graduate school. I don't know what the levels of mild, moderate, severe
look
like. Where
was this? Like the Meadows or something? Where did you go?
We didn't go to the Meadows, but I know I'm aware of them. And we looked into it near the end. That was what we considered having him go there. But it was a certified sex therapist that we saw. She'd been certified. And she was a psychologist too. She was the one that did the assessment on him. And I just looked at her thinking, you know, as a psychologist, I understand the words you mean. I know that severe means it's severe. And I know what severe depression means. I mean, that's somebody who can't get out of bed and can't function at all. I mean, literally, they can't function. So you're essentially saying this man can't function. But what does that mean? Does it mean, am I at risk? I mean, nobody is discussing the fact that he is putting me at risk, in danger, literally in danger. Yeah, so I felt very not protected by the system. I felt ignored. Just typical to growing up, surviving in this household with all this neglect. One more time, I'm being abandoned and neglected. I literally, when I walked out of the treatment program, I thought, well, that's great. He got some help. But I woke up, I'm like walking out broken. I'm walking out feeling worse and shattered because I was ignored to this whole program. But we get into Mexico. And the other thing that was said to me is, Carrie, this is a tip of the iceberg. You only know a little bit and there's a whole lot you don't know. And you just found out the little bit. And I'm thinking, okay, so what does that mean? So anyway, but we get into Mexico, and of course, you know, it continues to be an ongoing problem. And, you know, I'm seeing the, just like there's, I'm sure, I don't know because I've not lived with an alcoholic, but there's mood swings and cycle. Yes. There's a cycle to abuse. I definitely could start seeing the cycle with him where he's doing great and it starts to taper and it's doing really, really bad. Then there's this massive crash and then we get things start to do better and he just promises again and he starts to follow the program or do something and it starts to be really sweet and then it starts to fall again. And then, you know,
I was he going to SA?
He was going to AA, but not consistently. Okay. He was supposedly had a mentor, but I think he was lying and not meeting up with the guy. I mean, I think there was a lot of, deception. Mm-hmm. I have one of the times I found, asked his mentor, did he meet up with you for these meetings? No. And he said he was. So he is supposedly seeing a therapist the entire time that we were in Mexico. We had found really solid therapists with high, good credentials and a lot of expertise, and I'm not even sure. I know at least one time that he ditched his phone near the therapist's office and then did something else for that hour and a half. So I think there was an enormous amount of acting out, and I don't know the scope. In fact, near the end of the relationship, I said to him, I think this is what a typical day for you and I looks, and I described a day. I said, how close to that is that the truth? And he says, not at all. He had a double life. He led a double life. There's what I saw and what I thought we were living. And then there was what he was really doing. So it was a horrific relationship. Very, very,
was he spending a lot of money?
Mm-hmm. Yes. In fact, I just I'm getting ready for another discussion of this. So I was looking at our records and I was looking at how much I was spending on Amex during that period of time. Remember Mexico prices. Mm-hmm. I was spending way more than I am now. And what I spend now is for a business, you know. I was exceeding, you know. So here, to give you an example, our credit card bills were running us $6,000 to $9,000 a month in Mexico.
What was he spending it on?
We were eating out every time and here's how I enabled him. I could tell that if I kept him busy and kept doing new things, novel things, then he seemed to be more attentive and connected. So I was moving from, we would go to this adventure and then we'd take this excursion and then we'd stay at this hotel and we were constantly doing stuff because it kept him connected and kept us, made me feel like we're better. But
what kind of buying is love, right? In a way.
I didn't think of it that way. I felt like I was trying to buy connection, maybe, you know?
Yeah, or keep him busy. Yeah.
Yeah, kept him busy, kept him out. I guess I saw it as a mom, you know, if kept the kids busy, keep them out of trouble, you know? So yeah, I was keeping us busy, but it was like, you know, driving me and, you know, losing tons of money. I mean, and that's not how I normally live. We were literally eating out every meal of every day and doing something constantly. And as long as we were doing that, we felt, it felt good. It felt like really great between us, although it really wasn't, but it felt better. But if he'd get bored fast and he got restless and he was irritable, he was miserable to be around. So part of it was not just me buying attention. It was also me just trying to survive a not fun person to live with. So
real buzzkill.
He was miserable. I'd never met a more bored, restless, empty person who with not good goals, not direction, no direction to his life. I mean, he lived for fix to fix to fix to fix. He said he compared himself to a wolf and he said he was always hunting and he called women meat. And so he was, and I could see the women he was marking and grooming. I could watch him groom them. And sometimes I'd try to intervene and protect them from him.
What do we know about his family?
Well, I got to meet his family. His mom lived with us for 8 months.
Okay.
Yeah. So what I now know is his dad was a severe alcoholic, severe, and was a very abusive man, violent, horrible. And the family kind of all verified that, terribly afraid of him. He moved them constantly. Every child was born in a different state in Mexico. That's how much they were moving, how fast. Mm-hmm. And there were six kids. He was a womanizer, so he's cheating. So, and my husband, my ex-husband knew that because he one time had to go find him and found him at a hotel with a woman. Mm-hmm. So it was very overt. And then he abandoned the family after the first two kids went to college, got some education. He said, well, I've done my job. Now it's up to you to take care of your mom the rest of her life, which has been what the kids have done. So they have now, they house and take care of this woman who has no income and no welfare, no support. They have been basically and he's now passed away. He died of cancer, apparently. But again, I don't know. I can't verify that. That's just what was told to me. So I don't know if it's true. But so I met his mom. His mom said to me, of course, she didn't speak any English, so I couldn't have a big relationship with her. And she was pleasant most of the time. But she said, and at one of the Bible meetings that we had with people who spoke Spanish and could interpret, that she had been a bad mom. She had not been good, and she was better. That she, now that she had found some faith, that made her a little bit a better person. But he would tell me, be careful with her. And he was sincere. He was like, be careful with her. She's manipulative, exploitive. Don't trust her. That's what he'd say to me. Don't trust her. And then the stories he'd tell, I believe some of them were true, the way she pit, because I, you know, it happened in front of me, around me, how he found out she was giving money to one of his brothers that he'd been giving her for his, her living expenses. I mean, that happened. So I got to see it. And he'd confront her and say, you stop doing that, or I'm stop giving you any money. I'm not sponsoring my brother's life. So when he said, yeah, she preferred my brother and pit us against each other, I'm like, yeah, well, I see it happening now. That makes sense to me. So I do believe it was a really, really rough home, really bad, scary home. But I think this is me again thinking as a psychologist. I think his solution to this whole thing was, well, it was bad, but I'm not going to be a victim. I'm going to be the one with the power, and I want control of my life. And so he ended up emulating his father in this whole process.
I don't know if you know who Dr. Ken Adams is. He wrote the book called Secretly Seduced.
Mm-hmm.
He has a new book, and it's about adult children of sex addicts.
Yeah.
I had him on the podcast. It's really interesting.
Yeah, it was. I listened to it. It was really good. Yeah. It was very powerful. Yeah. Yeah. So here I am being coercively controlled. So this is what my life looked like. We'd get up. So I need a lot of sleep. And I told him that. But he would set the alarm for 6 a.m. in the morning, which I don't ever get up at 6 a.m. Normally in my life, when I had a practice, I would start my practice at 11 or noon. Mm-hmm. I'd get up around 10, and then I would go to bed maybe around 1 a.m. or something. So he would keep us up till 1, 2 a.m. or 3. He might be watching YouTube or whatever. Set the alarm for 6 a.m. Let it go off, wake us up. We'd do devotions in bed. Then he'd run us from appointment to appointment all day, because we ran the business together. So it was supposedly his job, and then there was my job, but we would do his job together all day. So we'd run all day. We wouldn't stop to eat or nothing until finally for dinner. We'd have dinner. So we'd eat maybe 4 or 5 o'clock, and then I'd have to do my job that we didn't do all day that night while he watched YouTube. And then he'd keep me up again, and then we'd do that day after day after day. That was my life. Was like that. And he was, you know, he was just manipulative, gaslighting, controlling, but all sweet, and was all covert, you know. Well, don't you think this is best? Or I can't help myself. Or what else do you want here? Or how else do you think this, you know, we have to do it this way because you're the president of the company. I mean, but I had no privacy. So if I took a phone call in front of him, he would be like, well, what's that? I'd get the, you know, 20 questions. What's that about? Or who are they? Or what do they want? And all of this type of intensity, which at the time I didn't know was abuse. I didn't recognize. I just thought this is not fun and it's not good. And I'm exhausted and not doing well, but I didn't see that as this is a person keeping me deprived, off kilter, and feeling really confused. And then I was confused because he kept saying he'd never worked so hard and he never loved someone so much. And yet his behavior screamed that he was still acting out and that he wasn't really. In fact, at one point I kind of described to him, I said, it feels like we're playing the hokey pokey. I said, do you know what that is? Because he didn't know. And I said, it feels like I get one arm and then I get a leg. I said, but you never put your whole self in.
That's what it's all about.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it's all about. But I never got the whole self. So yeah, it fell apart when we took another trip. We went to Barbados. I actually collapsed on an airplane. They thought I suffered a heart attack or had a stroke. Gosh. So I was really, really sick, really sick. And I was failing. I was like getting sicker as the relationship went on. But I collapsed and we got to Barbados. I felt pretty fragile. And we're wrapping up that trip. And as we're wrapping the trip up, he blew it. He lost it and became kind of more verbally abusive than he'd ever had before. Mm. He started accusing me of being stupid and not thinking. And he'd never done that before, you know, just really lost it. And I went out to the water and Barbados is like a big volcanic island. And I was standing on a ledge of that, you know, big volcanic piece. And the water is wearing away underneath. And I knew it was a ledge, but it was firm. I mean, it's volcanic. I didn't feel scared, but I thought this is wearing away. And one day this ledge will be worn away because of this constant, relentless beating on this piece of rock. I said, this is what he's doing to you. Mm-hmm. He's wearing you away. And one day there will be nothing left of you. And I just felt this sense of, you got to wake up. You got to wake up to this. Later that night, we sat at a picnic table and everybody around us were laughing and having fun and really having a great time. I looked across to him and I thought, he doesn't love me. How did I mistaken that he loved me? I mean, look around. I see love everywhere. There's no love here. How did I think that this is fool's gold? It looked like love, but it's not love. And then I got a phone call, a text actually from my youngest, who I said we had been off. We weren't really doing super great, but he texted me. That was super weird. And I said, you know what? I have to take that. This is something's wrong because my youngest doesn't communicate like this. So I took the call and found out that my oldest that was sick, seriously, seriously sick. We'd been staring at the wall, losing track of time. And I said, that's an emergency. You need to go to the hospital immediately and you need to call me when you do, because this is critical. Whatever this is, he's altered. This is critical. Well, he calls back and he says they've moved him into ICU. And I'm like, I knew that. I suspected it was that bad. Something was that bad. So I immediately got on a plane the next day, and midday as we're traveling, it took us all day to get there to into the United States. He called me and said, they're saying he's got cancer. So I knew that then my life was changing, and I didn't share this piece, but I had been trying to get the company control back to myself and get him off as a shareholder to, so I could control the money, because he was threatening to take me to court and take half of it if we divorced. So I was trying to get him to do that. And I could feel that this shift coming, because I knew it was going to be a shift, it's going to take me way out of Mexico, was going to open opportunities for me to break free from this marriage and possibly shift things back into my control. I could just feel that that was going to happen. And sure enough, that is what happened. Shortly after we got there, when Cameron came home, my oldest came home from his first round of, he had leukemia, his first round of chemotherapy. That night, my ex offered magnanimously to set the alarm to wake him up because Cam had a headache. So I got nervous and was sleeping out beside him because I was afraid what that might mean, because Cameron had proof of cancer in his spinal nervous system. So I was nervous of what this headache could mean. And I went to turn off the alarm in my ex's phone and found he'd been texting his girlfriend. And not only were they texting about meeting up again in the United States, but he and Hearst were talking about what the cost of Cameron's care was going to do to his half of the company assets. So I now then knew he'd been betraying me, not just personally and intimately, relationally, but he'd been betraying me financially.
How long had you guys been together at this point?
2 years. Okay. 2 years.
So 1 year into the marriage.
No, I knew him 3 years. I'm sorry. Okay, 2 years so two of years marriage. Yeah. Got it, got it. 2 years married, went 3 years. I knew him. So that next morning I got brave and I said, I know. I looked at him and I said, I know. And I left the phone out on the counter. And then the next day he left, he fled. And a week later, he texted me and said, I think, you know, I can't do this. It's too hard. I don't want out. And will you pay me off? He asked me to pay him off. So I did. I didn't pay him off the amount he wanted, but I paid him off. And he signed the paperwork and made me the sole owner. Well, actually, he made me the principal owner of the company. My son's the other co-owner. So we made that shift and we divorced.
How quickly?
Well, I got blessed because he wouldn't stop asking for more money and wouldn't stop pressuring me and intimidating me and threatening me. He started threatening to kill me at that point. And I was getting divorced in another state. I was getting divorced where I still had residency because I hadn't had residency in Texas yet. So I was getting divorced in Iowa. And I contacted the Iowa court because I was filing all myself, doing it all myself. And I said, I'm here in Texas. My son is gravely ill. And she said, have you filed a motion explaining your circumstances? I said, no, I haven't. She goes, you didn't hear this from me, but I would. So I filed it. And that was like, we just filed for divorce 3 weeks earlier. And I filed that motion. And that afternoon, the judge signed off and divorced us.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was divorced like literally in 3 weeks, which was the blessing because they were going to require us to go to mediation. And I knew if he did, he would again start to battle all this, you know, bring up how much money he thought and claimed that I owe. And, you know, you never know how that's going to go because he's so presentable and so credible. And I was really nervous. I kept saying, we have no property in the United States. We have no home. We have no bank account. What money are you after? There's no money here. We already settled. The only money that ever been is that company that's been settled. Why are you know, but he was not stopped. He wanted me basically to pay for 2 years of his life. That's what he literally was asking for. Was 2 years of all his expenses for the of his life. So yeah, it was, but so you asked, this is a long ass question or version of story to tell you how I realized.
Cool, I loved it.
Yeah. So I got done with all of that and I'm looking back at my life and I suddenly looked at my friendships too. And I could suddenly see this controlling, manipulative, whiny, you know, I was doing all this placating, caretaking, showing up, extra mile stuff for everybody, my whole life, everybody. And I realized that I had surrounded myself with dysfunctional people. So at that point, I basically just expunged my social life, just cleared it all out and went low contact with most of my family and started to try to repair the relationship I had with my sons, but washed my friendships off and started over, realizing that I just had been picked all these dysfunctional relationships. I had been surrounding myself with people who is that essentially what I had, or sort of, this is what I kind of learned. I had assumed that the way for me to be okay, this is the rule growing up in the family, the way for me to be okay is to make sure we're okay, the we are okay. So if I could invest out here, then it would make things better, then it would make things better for me. But I wasn't saying, what did I need to be okay? Mm-hmm. I would come last. And I often wasn't okay. That wasn't okay for me to do that out there. It cost me too much to do that out there. That I needed to start from me first. And then the we comes from the results of me being better. But it was back ass words. So that's what I am now trying to do very differently. But I'll tell you, it is so hard. Because I still, because of all the years I've done this, very, very hard to do. Very hard. And scary. It feels very scary to do it. Because it feels like, what if, because the other thing that happened right after I got out of that relationship, this is 2019, and my son finally is well and no longer needs treatment in 2020. Well, what happened in 2020? The pandemic set in. Okay, so I'm living in a studio. My kids and my relationship are still sort of estranged, despite the fact that I just helped my oldest with all this treatments and being a part of that. I've just washed all my friendships back off. And I'm going low contact with my family and I'm going into a pandemic and I work from home and work for myself. I'm alone. I go through that alone. Alone. And that had been the very thing I had been running from my whole life. Mm-hmm. And so I discovered something. I discovered that I like me. I discovered I'm a good friend to me. And that if I'm alone, I'm still not alone because I have me. And I'd never had that before. I never made that transition before. So today, when I get really scared, when I set a boundary and worried, well, they're going to hate me and disappear and not have them in my life, I think, yeah, but isn't that okay? Because you discovered going alone for a year that you can do this. You're okay. You've got you. And that's the bet. You'll never not have you. So it's okay. This is going to be okay. So that's what I talk myself through these days.
Two questions. The first being, when you were in that relationship, were you aware in the moment that you were in the midst of a trauma bond?
No, never even heard of a trauma bond. No, I didn't know. I found out afterwards. I did come on Patrick Carn's work and Betrayal Bond. I read the Betrayal Bond book right away. I still even remember being in that studio reading this book and underlining everything. Like, oh my goodness. And then I also realized I had a trauma bond with my parents. I had been trauma bonded probably to my first husband as well, to some degree. And that I certainly had been very trauma bonded to this guy. And breaking that, by the way, is miserable. It is one of the most painful things to do because you're just everything in you screams to have connection with this person. Even if it's fighting, at least it's connection. So it's very hard to do that. I try to help people these days. And I'm like, you have to have a plan. And you have to have a plan of how you're going to cope with every single moment so you don't reach out to this person or don't go back and look at your history or look at the pictures or whatever you do to try to soothe yourself with this connection. But no, I didn't know I had one.
It's harder than, I mean, as somebody who's, you know, a recovering alcoholic too, I mean, it's harder than getting sober.
Is it really?
It's more painful.
My co-host to the Breaking Free was Tara Blair Ball. I don't know if you know her, but she has a heroin. She's recovering from heroin addiction. She said it was worse than that.
Yeah.
She said, I can tell you, I had that. I did that. She goes, this felt worse. It is. The pull is so intense. And so what did I do? Here's what I did for my recovery. And wasn't intentional. I just like, I did what I knew. I immediately jumped into a group coaching program for 3 hours a week for a year, immediately. So I surrounded myself with people who are in the same journey, same place, same, you know, these were women who had been living with a sex addict. We could talk the language, no shame. We could talk about the really hard stuff. 3 hours a week for a year, I did this. And the other thing I did, I started writing again immediately. I started writing as we were divorcing, started telling our story, which is Love You More, because I kept thinking, I have to figure out the craziness. I have, because it doesn't, what happened didn't make sense. What happened? I don't know what happened. There are so many pieces that didn't make sense. But when I started putting it on paper, I could see through what happened. I could see the gaslighting. I could see the deception. I could see my confusion. And then when I stumbled onto chronic and persistent cognitive dissonance coming out of Sandra Brown's work, I don't know if you're familiar or are with that. That's because people like this create a dual reality. They literally are Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Mm-hmm. And you can't tell who you're living with. So you learn to live with both people. And you then create a reality inside of you how to survive both people. And that creates what's called cognitive dissonance. Mm-hmm. That confusion then actually creates executive function dysfunction. So you start to be, because the amygdala is overstimulated and you're in this constant state of hyper arousal, but also a state of can't define what's real, what's true, then your brain just goes into, I can't compute. And it literally starts to destroy the hippocampus and cause the amygdala to swell, causing real cognitive dysfunction. So the confusion people feel in these relationships is real. It's neurologically real. Mm-hmm. So for me to start to see the truth and break through the deception by me putting the stories down on paper, he said, I said, this happened. Then I could like, oh, there he was lying. Oh, okay. Now that I could start to piece it together and have the bigger picture. I even created a timeline of stuff. I mean, I really got deep into what happened to make sense of what I'd survived. And that gave me so much clarity, really, really, really helped me.
And then what was the process of coming to terms with your childhood and that like you had endured trauma? Was that like, what was your perspective of your upbringing prior to this?
Well, I had already like realized the shame of the abuse wasn't mine and had done some earlier work on that in therapy. Okay. So that part I was already done with. I didn't feel like embarrassed to say, yeah, I survived sexual abuse. But I think this just added a new piece because I realized near the end, in fact, I was in therapy, a lot of that relationship, by the way, I was seeing a therapist. And I remember realizing at some point that I was like, have you ever seen that children's book, Are You My Mommy? And it walks around and asks this big like semi truck and then asks, a dog, are you my mommy? I realized I had walked around to the world and including my ex asking, are you my mommy? Mm-hmm. And hoping I'm going to find this comfort here. And she gave me this exercise that I found so helpful. She said, Carrie, I want you to think about when you feel so distressed, ask yourself, is this an old feeling or a new feeling? She said, new feelings are you approach as an adult. And you have all the adult resources and you're going to be able to find a solution to it. An old feeling is coming from your childhood. Mm-hmm. And that's why it swamps you so bad. So when that happens, I want you to find the mom inside you and have her come up and give yourself a hug and pull yourself close. And I'll tell you that was the best advice. So that's what I started also doing. I started to really like, okay, I have to understand the fact that I have this wound. This wound's never going to go away. I will forever, I don't know what it feels like to have a nurturing, available, loving, supportive, involved mom. I basically raised myself. I was an orphan. I will walk around forever having that. But I do know what it is like. I am a mom. I am a good mom. I'm a great mom. I can mother myself. I know how to show up that way for me too. So it's helped me to sort of step into that gap. But I have a lot of grief over this. It feels unfair, and anger too. It feels unfair. It's wrong. I shouldn't have this hole in my life like this. I shouldn't, it will always make me vulnerable in relationships to wanting people to fill holes they can't fill. I know that. So I have to watch for that risk. I realize I hunger more for some things and I got to watch out for that. So yeah, it was kind of this big, it was more of an aha. It started like putting pieces together and gave me a little more coping mechanisms with it. What's making you slow now? Don't let it all go.